Hi, this is Elmore Leonard. I'm listening to Film Sociology, and it's a real program. It's great.
It's time to hear what's good, what's bad, and what's ugly at the multiplex and the art house. What's new on video and streaming, and you might also hear about some dead people we like.
We don't have time for dead people we don't like.
Anyway, this is Film Sociology, where you'll find out what's the next cinematic marvel.
It was unbelievable!
And what's just a movie.
Shut up! My God, you have no freaking life!
Okay, here's your host and my dad, Matthew Soucy.
Hello there, film lovers. Welcome to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. If you have a question or a comment, you can email me at msocey, that's M-S-O-C-E-Y, at WFYI.org. I'm also on Facebook, also on Twitter, at Matthew Soucy. This show is available on iTunes, and like all of the podcasts here at WFYI, available on Spotify. Well, friends, got through another week, and I appreciate everybody listening to the podcast and hanging in there, especially, I know some folks are going back to the movies in the actual theaters, some are not, and I know as far as content for me, it's been running a little low because of the back-to-back productions I've been involved with, like the play Elizabeth Rex, which is opening this weekend at the Theater at the Fort, 8920 Otis Avenue in Indianapolis. It's running through November 14th. You can go to IndieBardFest.com for tickets and information. I'm acting in this one as opposed to directing Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, and this is a fun romp and it's got some powerful moments and some great stories and great moments as far as gender relations on and off the stage. So go check that out if you want to see what I look like on stage. Abdul's in it too, as well as Alan Clough, who's an old WFYI friend. So anyway, go check that out, IndieBardFest.com. And then I'll hopefully be able to catch up on some more films. I'm going to dip into the archives, but first I want to start with grabbing a pencil. Let's find out what you've been watching over the last week or so, and working ahead sometimes helps in my case. We start on Twitter with Ray, who says that TCM, well, at the time of his post, is showing Fame tonight. Irene Cara. And then he puts in parentheses, Tyrone from DC Cab Reaction, DVR is set. Ray, I'm with you. Irene Cara is fun to look at in the early 80s. However, it's funny, we were in rehearsal for Elizabeth Rex and this film came up. And of course, the most uncomfortable scene came up that involves Irene Cara. If you know Fame, you know what I'm talking about. So, still a fine film, but man, that's a kick to the chest. Also had somebody on, I think it was Twitter, earlier this week, was stunned that Fame didn't win an Oscar for Best Editing. That year, however, was the year Thelma Schoonmaker got it well-deserved for Raging Bull. Just saying. Moving back to Twitter, let's see. Dave writes, Last Night in Soho and Raising Cain. Steve writes, The Killers, the one with Ava Gardner. Let's see. Terry writes, French Dispatch. Loved it. And I think that is all there on Twitter. Okay, moving over to Facebook from last week's post. Yeah, because that's what Twitter does. Facebook does. Mario writes, Heat, Black Widow, Life of Brian, and Dances with Wolves. Linda writes, The Last Duel, Hope Floats, Leap Year, and Catch and Release. And then chimes in, The Cure for Depression. I don't know if The Last Duel qualifies for that, Linda, but I know where what you were trying to say. Thank you. Michelle writes, Whiskey Tango Foxtrot, Knives Out, Victor Frankenstein, The Legend of Bagger Vance, Shooter, and then tried watching The Saint and Robert the Bruce, but got bored. It happens, Michelle. Kathleen writes, been watching TV. Thank you. Steve writes, I bought my partner the Funko Pop 13 Spooky Days calendar to count down to Halloween. We've watched the movie each character was from, with one exception. So far, Nightmare on Elm Street, Beetlejuice will be at the Art Craft, yes, The Shining, It, The Lost Boys, The Exorcist, Friday the 13th, and Annabelle. Also threw in The Creature from the Black Lagoon for good measure and Halloween Kills just because. And Steve put pictures up of the Funko Pop figures. Thank you. Stephanie writes The Exorcist, The Exorcist 3, and Poltergeist. And JD chimes in, The Exorcist is not only horrifying, it is an excellent motion picture. The Exorcist 3 is an underrated classic. I agree with you, JD. I remember seeing that in the theater and revisited again in my 30s and went, yeah, this is pretty good. It also helps that it's following Exorcist 2, The Heretic. And that's another discussion for another time. JD also chimes in with Phantasm and Murder by Death. Deb writes Dune. Eric Bryant, who is in Elizabeth Rex with me at Theater at the Fort, his post just says, none sadly. Okay, Eric has had a legitimate excuse. He's been rehearsing a play with me. I have not had any cause of that, but no, I'm with you, brother. Hang in there, and once the show opens, we'll be able to catch up on films separately and together. We'll see. Sam writes, Sam Watermeyer, Unbreakable, Last Night in Soho, and Halloween 6, The Curse of Michael Myers. Midwest Film Journal, Film Yap, Richard Probst's thing, and Sorry, Richard, and Medium Cool, all of and the Film Yap I mentioned. All of those are worth checking out when you're not listening to film sociology. My goodness. Devin writes Hocus Pocus. Bonnie writes Cat People, The Leopard Man, Metropolis, and Secondhand Lions. And then writes Husband's Pick. It's okay. It's still a good film. It's just not a scary film in October. I know you like to watch that stuff, Bonnie. Doug writes Halloween related, Phantom of the Opera from 1925, the original King Kong, The Leopard Man, It's the Great Pumpkin, Charlie Brown, Young Frankenstein, Suspiria, the original, Amityville Horror, Cloverfield, the 2018 documentary Carl Lemire, Lamelle, pardon my speaking, really. 1962 documentary Boxing Requiem for a Requiem for a Heavyweight, not a documentary, the feature film, as well as The Greatest. That's the film where Muhammad Ali stars as himself. And then he writes Chicago-related Divergent and Life Itself. Thank you, Doug. Michelle writes Dune. Kevin writes Live at Mr. Kelly's, Green Lantern, and The Book of Eli. Nick Rogers writes Jungle Cruise, One Shot, Finch, A Tale of Two Sisters, The Uninvited from 1944. I have that on Criterion Blu-ray, Nick. Good call there. The Lost Boys, Last Night in Soho, Old, Monster Squad, St. Maud, The Original Ghostbusters, Bergman Island, and Red Notice. Frank writes The French Dispatch, a lovely, so very Wes Anderson homage to the New Yorker magazine. Such a wonderful stop in Unisseur Blase, France. Pardon my French. John writes Legends of Oz, Dorothy Returns, Toy Story of Terror, and Nightmare of Christmas. Thank you, John. Taylor writes The Spy Who Dumped Me, Agatha Christie's Crooked House, Mars Attacks, The Martian, All the Pretty Horses, The Director's Cut of Daredevil, After the Thin Man, Horror of Dracula and the Pit and the Pendulum. Kathy writes No Time to Die. Melissa writes Hocus Pocus, Halloween 1 and 2, original, Final Girls, Animated Addams Family, and Monster Family. KC writes Midnight Run. Hadn't seen it. It was a romp. Yes, it was, KC. That and A Fish Called Wanda were the two films the summer of 1988, the summer I graduated high school, that I dragged that movie to, I dragged people to that movie who had told me they had not seen it. And then I think I saw both of them four or five times in the theater each. So there you go. Lou Harry writes Dracula AD 1972. Gotta lug the hippies and the soundtrack on that one. The Beta Test, Mainstream, Dating and New York, Black as Night, Army of Thieves, It Happened on Fifth Avenue, and Bergman Island. Thank you, Lou. Mark writes Once Upon a Time in Mexico. Brenda writes Let Him Go and News of the World. Dustin writes Quartet from 2012. Good call, Dustin. That's, of course, directed by Dustin Hoffman. This is a different Dustin. Janet writes In the Heights, West Side Story, The War with Grandpa, New in Town, The Devil's Advocate, For Love of the Game, Won't You Be My Neighbor? Thank you, Janet. Andrea writes Dune, Scream, and Us. Erica writes Elvira, Mistress of the Dark, the 1948 film Good News, and Riff Track Stuff I Don't Recall Right Now. Thank you, Chief. Just chime in when you do. It's okay. Kurt writes Young Frankenstein. Eric writes, I revisited two films from deepest childhood, a Boris Karloff, Bela Lugosi double feature straight out of local late shows from the 60s, The Black Cat and The Raven from 1934 and 1935. Good call, Eric. And by the way, there is a really cool Hollywood podcast called You Must Remember This, and I just finished a multiple episode series about the careers of Boris Karloff and Bela Lugosi. So check those out. And yeah, Halloween night, I revisited Ed Wood, which is my favorite Tim Burton film. So there, and of course, there's stuff I can quote, but I cannot. All right, moving on. Stephanie writes Golden Voices from 2019. Chris Lloyd, Film Yap, he writes Passing. The Beastmaster, and then writes in parentheses, don't judge. All right, Chris, I saw The Beastmaster in the theater in 1982. Yes, Tanya Roberts was fun to look at. There's some crazy stuff in that film. The beast that keeps crashing in the walls, John Amos looking like he should be giving away flowers at the airport, really buff Mark Singer. I'm going to guess I probably would need a pizza and a few beers before revisiting that, but I was 12 and I enjoyed it. So I'm not judging you, Chris. I'll judge you for other things. No, I'm kidding. Going back to Chris's list, Finch, Outlier, and Heart of Champions. Missy writes Dune and Free Guy. Jessica writes Dune, Hocus Pocus, Nightmare Before Christmas, The Exorcism of Emily Rose, Event Horizon, and The Thing, old and newer. Thank you, Jessica. Thank you for clarifying that. Some folks don't do that. Abby writes a variety of documentaries. Honestly, lost track of how many. That happens. The live-action Mulan and Dune. Daniel writes Dreamgirls, The Eyes of Laura Mars, California Suite, The Whistleblower, A Boy Named Charlie Brown, and Gone Girl. I need to revisit Gone Girl. It's on my Blu-ray pile. And yes, Rosamund Pike can make breakfast for me anytime. Mary writes Mildew from the Planet Zoander, Dawn of the Dead, Hotel Inferno, the original The Thing, Tarantula, and Psycho. David writes No Time to Die, The French Dispatch, Apocalypse Now Redux, and Star Trek Into Darkness. Or we do. D writes Halloween Town with the Grands. Thank you, D. Helen writes Ridicule from 1996. Mallory writes The Dracula from the 90s. It was hilarious and wonderful. Yeah, you got to take that with a grain of salt. And yes, we know Keanu's a little stiff, but you also have overacting Gary Oldman and Anthony Hopkins, and I love his Van Helsing. It's about as off-kilter as my performance of Van Helsing. And sorry on that, I played Van Helsing in a stage production a few years ago, and I didn't watch any of the Dracula films before, and then revisited them after, and I liked the take on Van Helsing just being a little not quite all there, and Hopkins did that. So great minds. He has a great mind. I'm just hosting this show. All right, back to the list. Mike writes Dune, Nightmare Before Christmas, and Frankenstein. Joshua writes Army of Thieves, Tenet, Bad Sports, The Invisible Man, and Promising Young Woman. That reminds me, Josh reminds me of this. Robert Irvine's going to be down in Lawrenceburg on November 13th, so go check out his website. I'm hoping to get him on the show very soon to talk about all the stuff he's got going on, including Hell or High Seas, and he's on television. I'll find out what films he's watched, hopefully. But Josh reminds me of that. So thank you, Josh. Jamie writes Hocus Pocus, Book of Life, and Coco. Kate writes all five Chucky movies, Jennifer's Body, Jawbreaker, and The Mummy. Wow. Which version of The Mummy, Kate? But that's a list. Don writes Better Off Dead, High Fidelity, and Lawrence of Arabia. Zachariah writes Cloverfield, Day of the Dead, Halloween Kills, and Repulsion, which he deemed disturbing. You are correct. Nancy writes Last Night in Soho. Margaret writes Days of the Bagnon Summer and The Girl on the Train. Jackie writes Tootsie. David writes Bad Sequel Week. Jaws 2 and Jaws 3. I even sat still for about 10 minutes of Jaws the Revenge, a film that I believe bought Michael Caine a house in the Caribbean. You are correct, David. And he also writes Die Hard 2. Now, wait a minute, David. I was an extra in Die Hard 2. That's not that bad a film. It's not a bad film. It is not a bad film, even if I wasn't in it. Anyway, Greg writes Grease 2, the worst. There you go. Dylan writes, The Island of Lost Souls, Spider Baby. We have watched this every Halloween for years. Wow, Dylan, way to go. The Manster, House on Haunted Hill, Sleepaway Camp, White Zombie, and Frankenhooker. Kathy writes all three of the Matrix films. Pat writes The French Dispatch. Jed writes, I've been on a classic noir kick. I watched The Verdict from 1946 with Peter Lorre and Sidney Greenstreet, and Three Strangers, also starring Lorre and Greenstreet. Very good, Jed. Michelle writes, Star Trek Beyond. I tried watching Hocus Pocus. I couldn't finish it. So dumb. World War Z. Tried watching The Saint. Couldn't finish that either. Hang in there, Michelle. Aaron writes, Silence of the Lambs. Jared writes, anything, everything Halloween themed. Jared watched everything that has a Halloween theme to it. So congratulations, Jared. Get some rest. Christian writes, The Evil Dead 2 and Hocus Pocus. Dee Dee writes, The Salem Witch Trials. Is this on a news feed? Is somebody have footage of the actual trial or the crucible maybe? That's Dee Dee Servino. Check out her podcast as well. It's fun. Andra writes, The French Dispatch and The Thing. Cassie writes, Desiree, a documentary on a vampire in London during the 1970s. Vin writes, Layer Cake. Chris writes, The Enforcer, a Bogart movie old enough. It explained to audiences what hits and contracts were. Solid film. Austin, medium cool. Dune and The Crow with Sam Wattemeyer chiming in. The Crow is one of my all-time favorite movies. There you go. Raymond writes, No Time to Die, Ron's Gone Wrong, and Dune. Robert Muggy, who I hopefully will be getting on Film Sociology soon. He's got a reissue of one of his documentaries coming up at the end of the month. The Todd Haynes documentary on the Velvet Underground, The Chess Players, The Strange Love of Martha Ivers, Woman of the Year, and the most recent, Dune. Deb writes, No Time to Die, and Inside Man. Dave writes, Frankenstein meets the space monster. It made my brain hurt. I'm sorry, Dave. Gary writes, The Satanist, Justin Morgan Had a Horse, The Last Duel, and Capricorn One. Chris writes, The Fly, the Vincent Price version. Martin writes, Dune and The French Dispatch. Yay, movies. Thank you, Martin. Kate writes, A Favorite, The Princess Bride. Lana writes, Army of Thieves and Lansky. Britt writes, Gremlins, all three Toy Story films, the Errol Flynn version of Robin Hood, Halloween Kills, Gangster Squad, Raiders of the Lost Ark, Toy Story 4, which got a complete set there, and The Shape of Water. Emily writes, I watched the new Dune movie and Over the Moon this weekend. Glenn writes, Dune, I'm in a rut. It's okay, Glenn. You'll get out of it. Glenn Dobbs, my director of Elizabeth Rex. That's happening at Lawrence. IndieBardFest.com for all the information. He knew I would do this. Cassandra writes, saw Dune on IMAX. It was epic. Lana chimes in, oh, I also saw Spencer. Thank you, Lana. James writes, Island of Lost Souls, Angel, Terror Train, Frankenstein's Daughter, the original Dracula, Monsters Crash the Pajama Party. Julia Ritchie writes, The Invisible Man from 1933, The Raven, 1935, The Original Frankenstein, and The Body Snatcher. David writes, Dune, Halloween Kills, The Original Halloween, Hocus Pocus, The Nightmare Before Christmas, and Tucker and Dale vs. Evil. Randy writes, The Velvet Underground documentary. Andrew writes, went to the theater and get big gas from Andrew and watch Dune. What a fantastic movie. Lila writes, saw Scream for the first time ever. Meh. And I'm kind of with you, Lila. You know, talking about cliches in movies and then doing them. Okay. Rachel writes, The Comancheros. Jim writes, The Babadook, Shot Caller, and Halloween. Spencer writes, Shadow in the Cloud. Can I have that hour and a half of my life back? Oh, well, apparently not, Spencer, so try again next time. Better film. Film you like. Kayla writes, Revisited Spy Kids and Spy Kids 2. No regrets. Beverly writes, Theater of Blood. Vincent Price. I love Theater of Blood. It's so campy and silly, and if you're a fan of Shakespeare, you should check that out. For Your Eyes Only, making our way through the Bond films. And Justin Kurzel's Macbeth, which was amazing. Thank you, Beverly. Andrew writes, Training Day. Joni writes, not a movie, but I started watching Brideshead Revisited. I think I may have watched it when I was in college in the 80s, but I definitely did. Thank you, Joni. Mark writes A Ghost Story, The Wolfman, and Dracula, all originals. David writes The Dead Don't Die. Todd writes Mank. Alan writes Pig. Harriet writes The Long, Long Trailer, Captain Blood, and Seven Brides for Seven Brothers. Larry writes Rear Window. David writes Dune. Doug writes Dune and Dear Evan Hansen. Teresa writes Ocean's 8, The Holiday, Hocus Pocus, and The Witches, the 2020 version. Emily writes Halloween Town 2, Calabar's Revenge. Terrence writes 3M. Jamie writes Dark Shadows. Terry writes Eyes Without a Face from 1960. And finally, Khalif writes The New James Bond, Thankful for the Closure, Waste of Time. The film is James Bond in name only. Well, that's harsh, Khalif. I know there are things that have never happened in a James Bond film before. It happens in this one, and I didn't mind it at all. So there you go, friends. I hope you have been able to jot down some titles and fall back on some films that are new, at least new to you, as well as falling back on old favorites. That's what I was trying to say. Thank you, everybody, for your contribution to public radio goodness. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. All right, I'm going to dip into the archives. We had Sammy Terry on the show last week. I got to play my interview with Rich Coase, a.k.a. Svengoolie. You can see Svengoolie Saturday nights at 8 o'clock on MeTV, and you can go to Svengoolie.com for all the information. I thought I had this small 15-minute chat of Sven with Rich with Emma, my daughter, Abdul-Hakim Shabazz. He and I are in Elizabeth Rex, IndieBardFest.com. IndieBardFest.com for all the ticket information there. And Rich, but apparently it is lost in the ether. I do, however, of course, have my long, epic interview with Rich. We had to reschedule it. He flaked out on us and admitted to it. He's like the first and only time he's ever flaked out on an interview. So I was able to get two out of him, one with Emma, Abdul, and I, because Abdul grew up in Chicago and actually remembers Svengoolie, then son of Svengoolie, and then back to Svengoolie. And then I got to see him when he was briefly on the air in Detroit, and then, of course, lived in the Chicago suburbs back in the 90s. Long story long, I'm going to replay my epic chat with Rich Coase about the history of Svengoolie and all things fun. So get some popcorn, go to Berwyn, and enjoy. You grew up in Chicago, right?
Yeah, I've pretty much spent my whole life here in Chicago, my whole life and even my whole career. I was born in Chicago, and about 4 years after that, we moved to some suburbs of Chicago.
Such as?
Around the Morton Grove Niles area.
As a kid, what horror show host did you watch?
I barely got in on one of the originals. I was very young, but I remember seeing at some relatives' houses when we were there late, Marvin, Terry Bennett, who hosted Chicago's Shock Theater. Back then, of course, that was the name. Shock was the name of the Universal movie package that was released all over the country.
Mm-hmm.
And that was where Vampyra was first running her stuff out in L.A. And in Chicago, it happened to go to WBKB-TV, where Terry Bennett worked, and he became Marvin, the sort of beatnik-type ghoul host.
That laid the foundation for Jerry G. Bishop?
Not so much, because I think Jerry was already out of town by then and working his way through radio to various cities, radio and TV.
How old were you when you started watching Jerry?
I was actually just about to enter college.
And what were your impressions of watching Jerry work on television?
Well, first of all, I'd been a fan of his anyway from his radio work. He'd been on the air doing morning radio and such for many years already before he even hit that. And I was a fan of his, so I, you know, was tuning in just because I heard that he was doing some funny shtick in between things as just a voiceover announcer for the horror movies on Friday night. And as it was developing along, you know, I enjoyed the character that he was portraying as well and how he was kind of, you know, positioning himself between the various segments of the movie.
Did he ever tell you how he developed the character?
He kind of was taking a tip from the famous Ernie Anderson, Goulardi,
uh-huh,
who was on opposite him on TV when he was working in Cleveland. But Goulardi was another sort of beatnik-type character. And Jerry decided to kind of update that and make it a sort of hippie ghoul. And so he kind of got the nod from that. And then he always said that his Svengoolie accent was kind of Bela Lugosi crossed with Yiddish.
That's a good way of putting it. Yeah.
Well, what was even funnier was he always described my accent as a combination of Bela Lugosi and Lawrence Welk.
So Berwyn really loves you.
I guess so, yeah. Much closer ties than I thought.
Well, it's interesting because looking back, because I asked the question I had earlier about the foundation for Jerry is because of the hippie persona, and then you mentioned the beatnik persona, it was interesting as a youngster with my local horror show host. I grew up in Michigan, and ours was Sir Graves Ghastly out of Detroit. Mm-hmm. Is on the surface, it was scary looking, but then I realized, looking back, he did a segment in drag. He did a segment German. He would paint his face, paint a face on his chin and uh-huh. be filmed upside down. And he'd show kids pictures. And in uh-huh. your case, looking at the early pictures, by the way, there's somebody here at work who grew up in Elkhart, and she wanted me to tell you, you scared her when she was a little kid.
See, I've heard that from a few people.
You're
here
right.
And there.
but the fact is, maybe the exterior was scary, but, you know, you're cracking jokes the entire time. And I thought, especially with Jerry's, it's a hippie. He's not a vampire or a ghoul or a zombie. It's, you know, it's a hippie that delivers one-liners.
Right, exactly. I think part of it is just that the characters, I always said, you know, there have always been people who said, you should try to act more scary. And I've often said, well, the only people who will be scared by that are, you know, kids under the age of 5. It's not very effective. If you're trying to act scary and, you know, people are wanted, they're going to go, oh, come on. Whereas making the character kind of comic relief to the horror is what seems to be what works. And for the most part, that's what most of the very successful hosts have done, whether it be tongue-in-cheek or, you know, just blatant, you know, goofballs like myself.
What did you think the first time you saw Count Floyd on SCTV?
I thought he was hilarious. It was funny because I had actually seen Joe Flaherty, who played Count Floyd, live at Second City while he was in his tenure here in Chicago. It was right after I got out of high school, in fact. And I thought he was a very funny guy to begin with. But then when I saw that, I thought it was really hilarious. And one of the things that somebody brought up is, you know, he obviously was still doing Second City here in town. He hadn't gone back up to Canada during the time that Jerry was doing his Svengoolie stuff here. So it seems like, you know, a little bit of that might have been, you know, added into his whole Count Floyd persona. The idea of, you know, running movies that maybe weren't quite, you know, what you would want to run during the time. Because Jerry had a few that were like, wait a minute, this isn't really a horror movie. And yeah, I thought Count Floyd was very, very funny.
Now, I know you started sending jokes to Jerry. What do you remember the first one he ever used?
I think it was something like, you'll love this one.
Okay.
What do you call a grave in Russia?
A what?
A communist plot.
Oh. You know what? I think that's being used on Fox News today, so it's all right.
Well, yes, it's right up their alley there. Yeah, so at first I was just sending him random jokes that I thought he could use because he was, you know, actually soliciting them from viewers. And then I let him know a little bit about what I was doing, that I was a broadcasting student. And I actually wrote something that was more specific for him. And he started to kind of request specific things, like, can you do a parody of such and such commercial or something like that. So it got into more long-form things than just separate jokes.
And how long before he invited you into the studio to work?
I would say it was at the most about a year, probably a little less than that. And he had me come in, and I ended up going in there, and he'd say, hey, can you do this voice for me off camera? And, you know, I did some artwork that he needed for the show. One of the guys working there then would jokingly refer to me as Jerry's art director. And he had me going with him and doing his public appearances with him, his various characters and such. And, you know, and it became pretty much he was trying to work it out so that I would have a full-time job at Channel 32. But before that happened, his Svengoolie show was canceled. So,
well, before the birth of Son, what did your parents hope you would be doing at this time?
You know, I don't know that they had any specific direction that they were hoping I would go in. My dad worked in sheet metal and ventilation, and I think he pretty much knew that I wasn't planning to go in that direction. They knew that I liked radio, and I think they kind of thought that I would go in that direction in broadcasting, but I don't know that they expected me to go into television as well.
Well, how did Son of Svengoolie come about?
Basically, what happened was there was a time in between when I became Son of Svengoolie and when Jerry stopped being Svengoolie that one of the guys that was a friend of Jerry's at one of the local stations had called him and said, you know, you should just do Svengoolie just as a summer fill-in thing for us here. And they talked about it a little bit, and Jerry was like, well, I don't know that I want to dress up in this stuff again. And he said, you know what? He said to me, why don't you could be like Son of Svengoolie, and then you and I can write and, you know, produce the thing together. And I was like, sure, that'd be cool. And then we talked about it, kicked it around, had some false starts on it, and nothing ever really happened with it. And then a couple years down the road, when Jerry was going to head out to San Diego to do radio and TV there, he said, well, you know, what are you planning on doing now? Because somebody else I had been working with, Dick Orkin, do you know him?
I've heard the name.
Famous radio guy who did radio commercials and did a lot of famous modern radio serials like Chicken Man.
Oh, right.
And the Tooth Fairy.
Yeah.
I'd been working with him, and he went off to L.A., and now Jerry was leaving, and he said, well, you know, what are you going to do? And I said, well, maybe I'll try to pitch some local station on a TV show and see if I can make any inroads there. And he said, I tell you what, if you want to try to do the Son of Svengoolie thing, you have my blessing. And so he kind of handed that off to me, and which was very flattering that he would, you know, take the character that he had created and kind of, you know, turned it over to me more or less.
Now, for those who don't go on YouTube, what was the, besides the look, what was the biggest difference between Jerry's character and yours?
Geez, let's see. Well, Jerry used to play the guitar and sing, and I cannot play the guitar well enough to do that.
We thank you for that.
Yes, yeah, anytime. Believe me, you wouldn't want to sit through that. But basically, it's the same type of character, you know, kind of mm-hmm. wisecracking. And I think Jerry's character, I don't know how to put this better, was a little more aggressive than mine. And I think that, you know, Sven is more, the one that I'm doing is more the Jack Benny character who's set upon by the other characters and such around him. Whereas Jerry was more, you know, the wise guy who was, you know, dealing with the others or something.
And, yeah, so you're the chicken butt of the jokes.
Yes, exactly. Well put.
Thank you. And when did was the chickens your creation, the flying chickens?
Oh, no, that went back to Jerry.
Okay.
You know, the famous old vaudeville prop of a rubber chicken.
Right.
He decided that whenever he would do some bad joke, which was pretty often, he would be pelted with those rather than tomatoes or something like that, or bricks, which would not have been pleasant.
Or the giant hook.
The giant hook, yes. That would have been much more difficult to have one of the stagehands maneuvering all the time. You got to also spread the fun to people, because if there's one thing people always request is, can I come and throw chickens at you?
Gee, I don't know what you're talking about. I think I'm at the bottom of the scroll right now.
I see.
My first viewing of you, of course, was syndicated on Channel 50 in Detroit, and this was in the early 80s. How did the syndication come about?
Well, after there had been various shows that had run back and forth, they had tried to run The Ghoul from one of the stations that was owned by, which company was it at the time? Kaiser, I guess, Kaiser Broadcasting. And they actually bumped Jerry Svengoolie off so that they could run The Ghoul. And he was not well accepted in Chicago because compared to Jerry's character, this was, you know, an interloper. And he didn't make any friends because we first started out saying, I'm like, yeah, we got rid of that bum Svengoolie.
Yeah,
nice work.
Nice.
But based on that and the fact that there was a guy in power at our Chicago station who was running all the field stations, they were field stations by then.
Right.
He really believed in what I was doing, and he wanted to get it on the other channels. And the funny thing was that we ended up on five different channels in different cities, but a lot of the stations, for some reason, felt that this was being forced on them, so they would not promote it, and you know, they would do nothing to help us out. And now, years later, I hear from people who watched me in the various cities, and they were like, oh, yeah, everybody used to watch that. And I had no idea that there was an audience watching me back then. And they say, oh, you went to Chicago after this. And I said, no, actually, I was in Chicago the whole time. And we would customize the opens and closes, especially, so that it would look like, you know, it was something, you know, with jokes playing off that specific city. It was kind of a pain because we'd have to reshoot every open and every close for each city, mm-hmm. and I'd have to rewrite it so that I would get in local jokes.
What were the other cities?
We were in San Francisco, Boston, Philadelphia, Detroit, and Chicago.
I remember because you made a crack on Bill Kennedy, who hosted the local show, the
right,
local movie
sure.
show in the afternoon. And I remember calling Channel 50 and asking about you, and they told me that you were based out of Chicago, and I didn't believe them.
No.
Because you mentioned Bill Kennedy. How did, you know, of course you know. So,
yeah. Well, it was funny because when we were going to do it, I asked each one of the stations, can you just send me a bunch of me, like a weatherman that I can make fun of, you know, various locations in the city, sports teams. Out of the stations, a couple of them sent really detailed stuff, and the rest were like, yeah, never mind.
Okay, I have to ask, how was Detroit's treatment of you?
Detroit was fairly weak. Sorry. They sent, like, just a little bit of information and a Detroit Pistons basketball jersey.
You still have it?
I believe I gave it to one of my brothers after the show was over.
How long did this last, the syndication?
It varied in the cities from, like, about 6 months to a year.
Okay.
And a lot of that was because they just, you know, they didn't promote it, and they felt like it was not, you know, it was not something they wanted to do. It wasn't their production. At one point, we actually went to Philadelphia and shot on their set. They built a whole set just for me to shoot on.
Wow.
And everybody there, for the most part, was not cooperative. You know, we were doing different bits and stuff. We ran a bit that was pretty famous that we did, Mr. Robber's Neighborhood.
Right.
Where, you know, I'm supposed to be like a Fred Rogers as a criminal who breaks into people's homes. That's why he changes his shoes so they can't hear him.
Right.
And he was talking about how he had a good sharp knife to do something with. And one of the engineers there goes, oh, that's nice, teaching kids to use knives.
Wow, this coming from Philly fans that cheer when Santa Claus get taken off on a stretcher at Eagles games.
Well, what can I tell you? So it was an uphill battle in most of those places, and I think that's why it didn't last, especially in a couple of those cities.
Well, from a kid standpoint, it felt like it was on longer, and I mean that as a compliment. And I think also because of the test of time, and there's no internet, and you had to be there for that time, unless you had a VHS or Betamax. You had to be there for that time to see the show.
Exactly. Yeah, that was it. You know, that's why I hear these people now who see the old clips and they go, wait, I remember when this was on in you know, San Francisco or whatever.
Yep.
It's quite a story. I think San Francisco was the city that we were in the longest, and that was like a full year. By then, all the others had dropped out.
Some of the other characters that you had now, was Durwood from the Jerry era, or was and you inherited him?
Yes, Durwood, the ventriloquist puppet, was from Jerry's era, and to this day, I wish he hadn't picked such a high falsetto voice, which he could do much better than I could, because I felt he should still have a similar type voice. You know, I didn't want to change the voice on it, but it's much harder for me to do. Tombstone was a character based on, really, he had a female skull named Zelda. And, again, I didn't want to do the exact same thing with that, so we created Tombstone. His name originally was Zalman T. Tombstone, Jr., and it was a playoff on the old Billy Saluga character, Raymond J. Johnson,
oh,
Jr., that was very popular
right.
at that time.
Yeah, yeah.
And Tombstone even had his own little litany, you know, like the you doesn't have to call me Johnson type thing, you know. But you can call me Toomey, or you could call me, and we did that at a while beginning. After all, I was like, I think people will be sick of this. Let's just try it.
I always imagined Tombstone, it sounded like if Bob Dylan and the Kingfish had a child.
Yeah, that's pretty close.
I'd okay.
say, definitely.
Tell us about the evolution of Kerwin.
Kerwin, yeah. Well, we've had a series of different sort of puppet-like assistants doing the mail. The first was our piano player, Doug.
Right.
And he was actually a live person. but he often couldn't stay around long enough because he's in actuality a working musician who constantly has different gigs all over the place. So he couldn't wait around until we got, you know, after we did the song to do the music. We did the music bits, and then we'd have to wait to do the mail after we did several other things, and he often couldn't stay around. So we just said, well, let's try some things. And we had a bat whose voice was like a sort of processed high tone thing.
Right.
And it was so annoying that one of the bosses in charge here actually said, I want you to get rid of it. And we had to actually do a bit where he was fired because he couldn't stand that voice. And then we, for a while, we had a pterodactyl who was a disc jockey who was the assistant, and a dinosaur, I believe. We're very into reptiles at times.
I see.
And finally, we had a spider for a while, and because he had eight legs, he had eight different voices, and for some reason that just didn't work at all. But finally, someone from our kids' show, Green Screen Adventures, a young lady named Jessica Hope Carlton, who is very adept at building puppets, kind of as a surprise, cooperating with my director, came up with this. She used like one of those sort of alligator type things you buy at the zoo. It's like a head on a stick, and you pull a little trigger to make it talk and move the mouth. And she combined that with the body of a rubber chicken and created Kerwin as a prehistoric rubber chicken.
Who sounds like Jerry Lewis.
Who, yeah, well, when I first looked at him, when they gave him to me, he had these kind of goofy eyes and funny teeth, and for some reason it struck me that he sort of looked like very young Jerry Lewis. So that was why he got the voice. It was kind of like this.
Do you also not bring up Dean Martin around him?
No, I constantly bring up Dean Martin just to make him angry.
So speaking of Doug, how do you select the music for the shows?
You know, I've often been asked by one of my coworkers, what are you thinking? Because I'll say, you know, I want to do something, you know, this is like flying to the moon. And he'll say, okay, and he comes up with all these songs with moon in it. And then I'll go, I know, and come up with some song that has no word moon in it. And he'll be like, wait, I don't get it. But there's some way that I can tie in certain lyrics that sound exactly like, you know, what the originals are that has something to do with the movie.
And how did you meet Doug?
Doug and I went to high school together, actually. We were in band together in high school. And we became friends and just hung around together. And when I started doing TV shows, I figured, you know, it would be great to have him help out.
What did you play?
I played trombone. It's been a long time since I played trombone, so please don't ask me to do a solo.
Oh, no, that's right. Well, we live in the land of J.J. Johnson. We wouldn't ask you to do that.
Well, but, certainly, yeah.
But I also imagined you as Woody Allen in Take the Money and Run, where you played the cello, but you also had to drag the chair during the parade.
Let me tell you, being a trombone player in a parade is not fun because you're right at the front of the band, because of the slide action, they put you there, and also, when you're playing, you don't get to look down and see if there's anything dropped by the horses that were earlier in the parade. That was one of the biggest hazards. And I always thought that doing marching band out on a field was one of the most unmusical experiences ever, because you think you're doing these formations and stuff, and half the instruments turn away from the stands while they're walking in, you know, some pattern, and that means they can't hear that part of the music. So it's like you're not hearing the whole, you know, thing like you do in a concert. What's the deal?
How did Jerry and you come up with all of those sound clips?
Well, with Jerry, it was a matter of, you know, he used them in his radio stuff. Mm-hmm. And he had a huge library of sound effects and little sound bites and things that he passed a lot of on to me. And actually, it was the same thing with me because I wanted to be in radio, and I also did that. I mean, maybe it's not as common anymore, but a lot of disc jockeys used to use little, you know,
sure,
these little sound bites, little, you know, cart type reactions, and because they were on audio carts that you throw into the machine. And I just built up this whole library. And of course, once I started here, a lot of the guys had suggestions for things or would find something in a show or in a commercial and say, oh, you know, you should really use this. So We've got it all. It's all now computerized, obviously, like everything else. It's all digital, and it's in a little machine that we can just call up a number and hit.
How many films or how many episodes do you record in one batch?
It varies. We've done as many as 9.
Wow.
Which is, you know, we're in the studio from noon until 9 o'clock every night when we do these.
Okay.
And that's a long haul. Believe me, being in that makeup for that length of time, not pleasant. But, yeah, we've done as many as 9, and a comfortable range is usually 5, I would say.
Okay.
Because that gives us a little, you know, easier time of it. And we're not, like, under the gun like, you know, Lucy in the Candy Factory.
And when you're selecting the films, is there a pattern? I mean, you know, sci-fi, horror, monster movie, killer movie. Is there a pattern of any kind?
Well, it's not so much a pattern. My idea usually is to try to vary it somewhat, because we do get people who will often complain about the fact that we're doing you know, too many mummy movies all at once, or too many Frankenstein movies. And, you know, to me, it's like, you're complaining about these Universal classics? Okay, whatever. But I try to vary them when I can. And also, there are certain ones that we have only a certain time window for. So we have to make sure that they can air only during, like, we've had movies that we can only run during 1 month.
Jeez.
So we have to, you know, make sure it gets in then. So a lot of times it depends on what the contractual window is, the window of time that we can fit the movies in, and, you know, what's available to us at what times.
Right off the top of your head, what are some of your favorite and least favorite films that you've shown over the years?
No, favorite ones, definitely Bride of Frankenstein. I do like House of Frankenstein. I got to run Nightmare on Elm Street, which I really enjoyed, and
wow.
Halloween, the originals. I really enjoyed those. Ones that I don't like as well, there's quite a few of those. I think I may have mentioned to you before the Midnight Movie Massacre, which was an absolutely terrible movie. There was one movie that I often cannot remember, Track of the Vampire,
oh.
Which is so bad and boring. It's a movie where half of it was shot in California and the other half was shot in Yugoslavia, and neither side knew what the other side was doing. And it was so bad that when I was at Channel 32, we actually intercut it with a bunch of other things. And we did one whole segment that was kind of, you know, Spencer around, where it had changed, and suddenly the woman, it's a scene where this woman is being chased all through the city and into the ocean by the vampire.
Mm-hmm.
And with my redubbing, it became the fact that she was supposed to show up for swim team practice and didn't want to. And that was the coach running after her. And at times there was like a bald lifeguard who showed up. So naturally his voice became that of Curly Howard from the Three Stooges.
Of course.
So, yeah, that was one of the really, really awful ones.
I would say, is it the quality of the film that gets it a Spencer Round treatment? Or have you? I think I remember once you did it with, even with Night of the Living Dead.
We did separate scenes from that. A lot of times I'll lift scenes, and so it doesn't interrupt the flow of the movie, or, you know, ruin people's enjoyment of the actual movie itself. If it's a really bad movie, a lot of times the only way to save it is to do something like add some sound effects to it along the way.
Now, I know there was one of the writers from Mystery Science Theater 3000 grew up in Chicago. Have you made contact with any of those guys before?
No, I've never been in contact with them. I've heard from other people that, you know, they've done little shout-outs to Sven in some of their shows. That one guy said he went to some convention and dressed as me and ran into one of them, and the guy immediately said, "Hey, your son is Sven Gulli."
Okay.
they know about it. And I remember reading an article in the Chicago Tribune where they were talking to a couple of the guys, and they said, you know, we weren't the type of guys who were trying to, you know, pick up Cousin Brucey on the radio from New York or whatever like that. We were trying to watch people like Ray Rayner, who did a morning kids show here in Chicago, and Sven Gulli. So they were aware of both, and they obviously saw both Jerry Sven Gulli and my son of Sven Gulli.
Have you ever talked to any of the filmmakers or actors whose movies you've aired?
Very rarely. You know, a lot of them right now, of course, a lot of these Universal folks,
a lot of them
not
are
around. although I did hear, I've got a couple guys who do a great website called Terror from Beyond the Daves. And they have a blog about different horror hosts and horror-oriented things. And they both are guys who grew up watching me and are big fans. And now, especially with our national exposure, when they go to conventions, they get a lot of feedback about the show from people. They ran into Julie Adams, who was the beautiful woman in the white bathing suit in Creature from the Black Lagoon.
Yes.
And she was just thrilled to hear that, you know, we show her her movie on our program. The same thing with Tippi Hedren from The Birds.
Sure.
We ran at The Birds here in Chicago and won the time slot, which was just, you know, incredible. It's like Svengoolie winning the time slot. Good grief. But she was another one who was just thrilled to hear that we were running that show on free broadcast TV, since it hasn't appeared on that very much. And it's just really great to, you know, get even these secondhand things. I did meet Robert Englund, Freddy Krueger. And it turns out he's a big fan of my show. He's been watching it out in California now, and he's had a lot of very complimentary things to say about it, which is really nice. Lance Henriksen, mm-hmm. met up with him. He's a very nice guy. It was a lot of fun and seemed to enjoy the show. We ran him in Pumpkinhead a couple
yes.
times.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Piranha 2 as well. So
well, that's good.
Yes.
How often are you allowed in Berwyn?
I'm allowed there any darn time I want to be there.
Do you have the key to the city yet?
They don't even need a key. I've got like a key card. It just lets me in and out. It's not a problem. Actually, yeah, it's funny because just about, I'd say, 95% of the people in Berwyn love that we do the stuff that we do about that city, and they know it's just jokes. For a while, they had a mayor who was you know, oh, you know, we don't want to be the butt of Svengoolie's jokes, and yet any time I'd show up there, he always make sure he was there to get a picture shaking my hand.
Politician.
Yes, and occasionally it's like the people who are like, oh, you know, you shouldn't make fun of our town. But the thing is, every time I've done a radio interview or TV interview, and people have asked about Berwyn, I've always, you know, stated what I just told you and the fact that it's a really nice suburb. The people are very nice there. They're all hardworking people, and now they're trying to be, you know, a little more upscale, and they're adding more arts and things, and, you know, God bless them. It's a nice place, and it also has my favorite horror collectibles store, a place called Horror Bolts, which has a real nice stock of all sorts of things.
How did you pick Berwyn out of all the towns for the bit?
That was Jerry's doing. Back when he was trying to figure it out, he had always when he was in Cleveland, Goulardi, Ernie Anderson, made fun of a suburb called Parma. And when he came here, he had that in mind. And he also, at that time, Rona Martin's Laugh-In was kind of winding down.
Uh-huh.
And they were making fun of beautiful downtown Burbank, as was Johnny Carson. And he thought, well, we need to do something like that. We can make small-town jokes about that. It'd be funny. And he was trying to decide on something. And he ended up having a sponsor that was from the Berwyn area. And when he went there, it seemed like the one street, Ogden Avenue, was all savings and loans and used car lots. And then he found out that they had the yearly parade in honor of mushrooms, the Hobie Parade. Hobie is Czech for mushroom.
Yeah.
And he decided this would be a good place to use as our city that we kind of poke fun at.
Well, it has a flow to it compared to, say, Downers Grove, Westmont, or Wheaton.
Yeah, you can't go like Cicero. It doesn't flow as well as Berwyn.
Is there a film that you've always wanted to show and have not had a chance to do yet?
Yes, Fiend Without a Face. Do you know that movie?
The French film, right?
No.
Oh
no,
no. I'm thinking of Eyes Without a Face. I'm sorry.
No. This is like a cheapo. I think it's an America International one.
Okay.
Where there's something invisible that is killing people, and they're not sure what it is. And at some point, they find a way to make them visible, and it turns out there are these brains with spinal columns that kind of like inch along. They were done with stop motion animation. And when they are fighting with them, when you shoot one, it makes a noise like a whoopee cushion kind of, and lets loose the sort of raspberry jelly type stuff.
Is this the flying brains with the eyes? Or am I thinking of something else?
You may be confusing it with the brain from Planet Eros.
Ah, okay. All right.
But these, you would remember these right away because they're smaller brains, about the size of a human brain, but they have this sort of spinal column, and they inch along like an inchworm using that. And they can also, like, leap through the air.
Well, this is my YouTube project for the day. That's good.
All right. Yes, you'll enjoy it. Believe me.
Now, how long have you been with the U?
I have been here since 1995. At WCIU, and then as we've added more stations, my shows have gone on to the various stations, and including now our network, MeTV.
How did the MeTV deal come about?
because of the great success we had here in town, when the U first went on, it was kind of a hybrid of what MeTV is and also a little more modern type programming that we would manage to get. And as we went along, my boss, Neil Saban, who was like a genius, had noticed that like Nick at Night and TV Land were changing dramatically. And they weren't what they originally were supposed to be, you know, with this classic TV stuff. And he had this idea of making MeTV station, which we did first locally here, and he felt that there was viability to that across the country since, you know, people weren't really getting that presented the way that we presented. And he managed to start, you know, start the wheels in motion, and now we're in almost 80% of the country.
Cool.
And it's especially amazing that it happened in about a year's time to have that kind of progress. Really says a lot for what Neil could do and what the MeTV National Network can do.
I'd say you could call those other syndicated cities from the 80s and blow raspberries at them, but they're probably not there anymore or probably dead.
Well, you never know. Yeah, most of the people involved have probably moved on and are not quite around anymore or, yeah, have been deposed. Knowing the nature of television, they probably lost their jobs. And
they're mad as hell and they're not going to take it anymore.
Yes, and I'll shed a tear for them like that Indian standing alongside the highway.
For MeTV, is it strictly Universal Films?
Right now it is, yeah. We have a really nice contract with Universal, and we're actually working on an extension of that for the future that would add in even more films for us. And we're hoping that that'll happen. And this is really, you know, the first broadcast TV national exposure for these Universal horror films since many, many years ago.
Which I think is a really cool thing. I know recently there's been films like The Mole People, which I haven't seen in a long, long time. And I know the horror film with Dirk Benedict and Strother Martin. I mean, those are ones I can't even think of the last time I saw
those. Yeah, you're talking about the...
But I think it's cool that you look for films that have not seen the light of day in a long time.
Yeah, and I think it's really an education for a lot of people because there is a generation that hasn't seen these. When we were kids, it seemed like they ran them much more on television. And now, if they run at all, they've run on cable as opposed to on, you know, actual broadcast TV. So the fact that we're kind of, you know, reintroducing these to a lot of people who maybe never saw them before is really great. And it's nice to continue the Universal legacy.
And also, from an educational standpoint, I love when you do a segment based on who these actors appeared in, you know, what other films they've appeared in, what the director has worked on. You know, when my daughter saw that Bela Lugosi played the Frankenstein monster, that blew her lid a little bit in a good way.
Sure, yeah. There are things that people really don't expect or, you know, they don't know about connections to various things. Like the people who ended up playing some other part on a TV series years later that they had no idea that ever happened. So it's very cool to be able to, you know, make these connections for people or just remind people, you know, this guy also did this. And at times it's really a tribute to the versatility of the actors, and it's great to show that they had a wide enough range to do so many things.
You're walking IMDb, sir.
Yeah. No, I'm sitting right now, actually.
And I know also you've also been showing comedy shows, and don't listen to the internet. There's nothing wrong with that, with showing, you know, I know you've done the Three Stooges Marathon and Abbott and Costello. And
yeah.
You know.
Well, most of the Abbott and Costello stuff we've shown still has a horror element to it. It's not, you know, we're not just showing, you know, Hit the Ice or something like that.
Right.
Abbott and Costello Meet the Mummy or you know, Frankenstein or whoever. We've thrown in a few things here and there. Yeah, well, you know, Ghost and Mr. Chicken, there's still like a horror
sure.
scare element to that. If anything, you know, we've run some Marx Brothers movies, and that's mainly because I'm a big fan of the Marx Brothers. They were a big influence on me. And, you know, I love when people are like, oh, this is wrong. You should be showing only scary things. And it's like, have you noticed that a great portion of my part of the show is comedy?
Yeah.
I don't know.
And we also like that, you know, you air it the same reason why dogs lick their elbows, because you can.
There you go. Exactly.
And also,
thanks for saying elbows.
Well, yes. Thank you for saying elbows, too. And also, it's really cool that the show on MeTV, you kind of become an ambassador for local horror show hosts. It's a lost art. I mean, we have Sammy Terry popping up every few months here in Indianapolis, but it's cool for you to give shout outs to cities that have had hosts, and you show other hosts, and even show old photos of Jerry and you. It's a lost art, I think, for local television.
Well, with the way that television has been going now in the TV economy, most local stations do not do entertainment-type shows. They're mainly, you know, if they have budgets, they're going to do news and sports and public affairs and an occasional magazine show. But, you know, they're not going to do something that's strictly entertainment because, according to them, it doesn't generate enough money to justify, you know, the studio time and editing time and everything like that. And when we first started here locally, the people in charge of the station said, you know, well, maybe we're not going to make money on this, but it's an important part of TV and something that viewers really get an attachment to and make a connection with, and that's important to us. Mm-hmm. And now, of course, you know, we're doing very well, and it's nice to see that people, you know, every email I get from out of town, for the most part, will mention, we haven't had anything in town like this since, you know, in the 70s with, you know, Dr. Bad Teeth or something like that. So there's always, everybody's got a horror host they watch sometime in their life, it seems.
Do you shows strictly for MeTV, and then you do shows strictly for the U?
We have some shows that run basically, well, the ones that run on MeTV right now also run on the U as like a week delay basis. But then on the U2, we run some of the older ones that we have that we still have rights to or that are public domain. And I also do a Three Stooges show, Stoogiepalooza, that runs on Saturday nights on our MeToo channel.
So I was going to say, how often do you get to appear on TV as Rich?
Every week.
Okay.
Basically,
there
yeah.
There you go.
So, yeah, it's I'm in the makeup, I'm out of the makeup. In the makeup, out of the makeup.
Well, you know, it keeps you young, maybe.
Well, I don't know about that.
Or young at heart.
Okay, I'll go with that.
So what's next for Svengoolie?
Right now, it seems like we're just continuing to go to more and more of the places in America. More and more stations are picking up the MeTV network and getting better distribution of it. And a lot of them, we started out just over the air, and now it's going to cable as well in a lot of the cities, and wider distribution in a lot of the cities. There are a lot of rumors about out on the West Coast that we're going to have more visibility out there. So I think it's just a matter of the Sven Show catching on in these various places, and then I think the next step after that is possibly starting to make public appearances all over the country, which should be fun.
Well, you know, you have a place to crash in Indianapolis, that's for sure.
Well, thanks, I appreciate that.
There you go, Rich Coase. Of course, Svengoolie, Saturday nights at 8 o'clock on MeTV. If you are not at Elizabeth Rex, happening this weekend through November 14th, go to IndieBarredFest.com for all the ticket information. You'll see me on stage and Abdul and way more talented actors than us. Yeah, I'm lumping him in with me. Anyway, friends, some words to live by.
Silent breed is people!
Zardoz has spoken.
Go see a good movie. You deserve it. There's plenty out there, and hopefully you find some new films that are at least new or new to you, as well as falling back on old favorites. And hopefully I'll have some ideas about films I've actually watched for next week's program. And until next time, take care, everybody. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. Good afternoon, Fort Myers. Good afternoon, California. Good afternoon, Michigan. Here's a little Svengoolie music to take us out.
Calling all stations, clear the air lanes, clear all air lanes for the big broadcast.
Hey, this thing on? Testing, hello, 1, 2.
I can't believe you let her watch Manos. Is she scarred for life?
Let's put it this way.
What kind of parent are you?
When I wake her up, I vocalize the theme to wake her up to get her ready to school.
Oh, you're a terrible father.
We'll do it live.
Okay.
We'll do it live!